We respectfully acknowledge the traditional owners of country throughout Australia where this podcast was recorded as the first storytellers, the first communities, and the first creators of Australian culture. We pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Hi there, I'm Daniel Moore, and you're listening to Season 4 of the Hearing Architecture Podcast, proudly sponsored by Brickworks. In this episode, I'm speaking with registered architect Mike Sneed, director of EKD Architects based in Western Australia. Mike is uniquely placed in the Australian architecture profession as one of the most isolated architects in the country. Working between three offices in Kununurra, Broome and Fremantle, EKD is heavily involved in advocacy for the architecture profession with a growing reputation of design empathy and building regional capacity in northwestern Australia. In this episode, Mike and I discuss his decision to work with some of the most remote communities on Earth, his passion for working on projects that support First Nations people, and the realities of designing for places and people that require a different design approach than in standard urban settings. Let's jump in. No, well, thank you so much for joining me today, Mike. It's really awesome to have you on the podcast. How are you going over there in WA?
Yeah, good. So I'm coming to you today from Mirong Gadjuwon country, and I'd also like to acknowledge traditional owners from our old office in Broome from Yaru country. Yeah, loving life at the moment. It's wet season at the moment, so wet season's the best season.
Yeah, get a bit of relief.
Yeah, the team and I are getting out and, you know, taking a break from the office and checking out some of the magical spots that, you know, there is to offer around here. Poor Matt in our Broome office is stuck in the heat and the beach on the west side there, but it's great.
Nice. Are you guys taking advantage of Skylink to get your internet up there, or
what? It's a given. So I guess to give you context of how remote we are, Daniel, about when I first started the practice, I was sort of launching everything up, and, you know, the chaos it is trying to start any kind of business or organization, the internet dropped out. And, you know, I was trying to send emails and I was trying to set up websites and do all that kind of stuff. And it turns out it just rained and a cow had stepped through a Telstra cable.
Oh, my God.
So a cow knocked out the entire internet for the town because the ground got a little bit wet and it walked across it. True story, walked across it, knocked out the Telstra cable. So now we 100% rely on, you know, the old, we won't go into brand names or anything, but the old internet satellites.
Right. Yeah, right. Okay. Wow. Yeah. I think it was very interesting when I received your EOI that you were mentioning that you're one of the most isolated architecture firms in Australia. So do you want to give us some context about
So when you look at, like, you know, I love numbers and statistics, so don't judge me on that. But when you look at remoteness areas of, you know, several key maps that you can reference, something like the BOM, the Bureau of Statistics, my apologies. Okay. I've been looking at the BOM all week because the rainfall and et cetera. You know, we're considered very remote Australia. To give you, you know, a point of reference, Alice Springs is considered remote Australia. So we're considered more remote than Alice Springs. When you look at, you know, rural health force incentives, that's a really good way to sort of, because it's a Monash modified model, you've got a scale of 1 to 7 of how remote a place is. Somewhere like Coffs Harbour is about a 3. Somewhere like Darwin is about a 2. Alice Springs is about a 5. And we're about a 7. So that just gives you, you know, indication of how remote we are. You know, we're 3,000 Ks from Perth, from the Kununurra office, a bit closer from the Broome office. Between the Broome and the Kununurra office, we're about 1,050 Ks. And then the closest major city.
1,050 Ks.
1,050 Ks, yeah.
Whoa, okay. And what? And so what is that, like 4 hours, 5 hours?
In a plane or by car?
By car. That would go at 10 hours.
Yeah, it's about 11.
Oh, my God.
Depending on road conditions and that sort of thing. It's a full day drive. So I do the round sort of every month or 2 months where I drive from here and go to all the projects we have along the way between here and Broome. And some of the remote communities we just have good relationships with, just to visit. So, yeah, we do a lot of driving and traveling. And our closest major capital is actually Darwin to Kununurra. And even from Broome, I'd probably say, because we're about 850 Ks to Darwin. Yeah, right. We sit in this weird flux. You know, there's, you call up a product supplier and you'd be like, you know, do you deliver to the NT? And they'd sort of be like, oh, we can't deliver to the NT because you're technically part of WA.
Mm-hmm.
It's this, I'm sure many other architects, particularly along the eastern seaboard, face sort of similar challenges, you know, proximity to borders, you know, Echuca being one town, one side of the border and the other side. We sort of feel that pain in regards to supply. And I think it was quite pronounced during that COVID period when WA had the hard borders shut down. You know, for us it was, I'm rambling over here, but for us it was fantastic because they shut it down to each shire. I could drive for a solid day and not leave the shire. So it's
wow. Just,
yeah, it's I think the scale that people, you know, forget about in remote Australia is something to behold. And there's something magical about, you know, being able to go out and not see anyone. You know, just to go out in the bush, go for a walk, not hear any noises, not see anyone, just be, you know, just a bit of quietude and just a bit of peacefulness. I find that sort of quite restorative, something we sort of lose, you know, particularly when you move to the city.
Yeah. And so you must have studied in one of the cities either around Australia or overseas. So where did you study when you were you know, doing your architecture degree?
Yeah, so I've had a bit of a weird patchwork of education and past. So I'm originally from a small town south of Perth.
Mm-hmm.
Most people would know it as the Bogan capital of West Australia. So from Rockingham, so not where your typical architects kind of come from.
Mm-hmm.
And I really struggled in school because I just couldn't sit still. I couldn't pay attention. I loved drawing. I loved art. I loved technical stuff, but I just couldn't sit still. I just, it's not built into me. So I went out, did a pre-apprenticeship in metal fabrication, and then inadvertently ended up studying engineering. So I actually studied engineering in Perth and then went on to study surveying as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then later, sort of once I sort of was able to sit down and draw for, you know, solid 8 hours, that's when I was actually able to go back into study architecture and follow that passion of mine after I'd done project management, site management for a number of years. So I guess my background is very much on site, on the tools, you know, started out as a brickies labourer, you know, made bricks, you know, did all the kind of jobs that I, you know, not sound like an old rambling old man here, but I think are really good for architecture students to go out and just do, just for a season, earn a bit of money, learn about how sites operate, you know, what people grumble about when they read architectural plans, all that sort of thing. So, yeah.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
Yeah.
So. And then so was it your experience working as a surveyor and being out on maybe remote or regional building sites that inspired you to want to set up such remote architecture studios?
Yeah, so I guess earlier on in life, the primary school that my brother and I went to had 15 kids.
Mm-hmm.
That was including my brother and I. So we never used to wear shoes to school. We never used to wear shirts or anything. It was some would call chaos, but, you know, we had some of the best childhoods, you know, you could ever imagine. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to move back to rural Australia to sort of get back in touch with, you know, just being more humble, being more aware of, you know, what's going on around me. But I knew that was going to be a difficult path with architecture and also with, you know, families and love interests, et cetera, et cetera. So I met my partner whilst I was living in Perth in Fremantle.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a very sort of similar perspective on things and had done all of her training in Broome.
Mm-hmm.
And when we met each other, it kind of clicked. We went, yeah, we found the right people together. And, you know, Megan and I, let's move bush. And, you know, I give all my practice credit to her because, you know, without her financial, mainly emotional support, there just wouldn't be our practice like it is today. And nor would we have been able to set up and operate in the sort of, you know, semi-socialist approach that we have at the moment. So yeah, we were sitting at a pub in Fremantle one day, and I was whinging about some, you know, gaudy architectural detail of a building adjacent. And, you know, we saw an advert for a job that she could take, and there was a job for a government position that I could take. And we just committed. We just went, yep, let's just give it a go.
That's fantastic, because I think there's some interesting conversations happening in the cities about regional or just even outer suburb living, where people are saying, you know, there's social isolation, and that's really a bad thing, and we need to make sure that people have access to the metro areas. But it seems like you've almost had the reverse, you know, impact, where moving to a more regional and more isolated place has actually given you, you know, a better life balance, or a better outlook for your stress and your, you know, fulfillment in your job.
Yeah, and I guess as well, a lot of people don't appreciate the dire need for professionals to move to remote places. You know, to give architecture as a baseline, you know, there's what, 2.6 million people that live in, well, I'll use Western Australia as an example, Western Australia. You know, of that 2.6, roughly 25% live in regional or remote Australia. But I can assure you there's not 25% of architects living regionally or remote. You know, so there is a, you know, not just architects, but engineers, quantity surveyors, any professional. There is such a dire need for professionals to move to these remote locations. And the flow-on effects to the community are immense. You know, these are people that are bringing their partners who are also highly, highly skilled. They're bringing kids who, you know, are going to go study at local schools. It's the flow-on effect is immense. And that's, you know, that's been my objective of the past, you know, 12 to 18 months, is to really elevate the, I guess, the apparentness of professionals needed to remote locations. Because, you know, when governments come out, they're like, oh, look, you know, here's all this money for apprenticeships and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's never any money put aside for professionals or moving professionals to those places. And we're not elevating remote and regional Australia by doing that. We're putting them behind the city, because they're always going to be reliant on the city to deliver those professional services. And they, you know, from our experience with our projects, there is a lot of, how to put this, local nuance, which helps.
Yeah. I mean, you can absolutely relate to what people talk to you about, you know, when they're giving you a brief for their, you know, their bespoke project for their bespoke community, and, you know, they don't have some of the advantages of, you know, if it's, say, it's for a residential project, you know, if I don't have it, maybe there's a neighbor who has it, so that then we can, or a friend, so that, you know, if they wanted a pool, but they're like, oh, no, I actually can't afford it. But, you know, there's a great local pool only 5 minutes down the road, so that's not a big problem.
Yeah.
When you're going through
those sort of conversations. It's also about understanding, you know, how people live as well, and what they can and can't get, you know. And, like, there's a big bridge between us and Perth. You know, there's 7 single lane bridges between us and the capital city. You know, so just even knowing what can be taken in terms of freight up here.
And, you know, everyone during the wet season?
It's a nightmare. We were isolated for 3 days, sort of, I guess that's the middle of January.
Oh, wow.
Shipping shut off either side. Even though they built a new Fitzroy Bridge, it's still, water levels still go up, you know, between there and Halls Creek. But yeah, I mean, it's funny because people ask me, they're like, how do you survive as a regional practice? Is there enough work? Is there enough this, that? And I pose them the question. I'm like, how do you survive as a city-based practice? You know, we used to have a studio, you know, a wet season studio, we used to call it. Like a little studio offering Mount with sublease from a graphic designer that we would, you know, occupy when we came down to the city to sort of have meetings and that sort of thing. And in that one city block, I kid you not, there were 16 architects.
Whoa.
So,
wow.
Yeah, it's, then you sort of step back and you go, how does this work? That's foreign to me. I know, you know, what we do is quite foreign to other people, but, you know, sort of the survival rate of some of those practices, you just sort of, where does all this need come from in the city?
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess, you know, there's like every firm has got its little differences and things, but the way people practice when they're all based very close together and they're working probably in, or they might be working on similar projects in, you know, certain suburban areas around their city. So the way that they practice must be the same. But for you, I think with your isolated projects, you've already mentioned the thing about just accessibility to materials. What are some of the considerations that you have to make on your projects when you're considering what materials you can use or what trades you'll have access to?
Look, first of all, we're more client selective than we are project selective. You know, we've done everything from, you know, we've asked them in quote on cattle loading ramps right the way through to remote schools, right the way through to medical clinics, you know, housing offices. You know, one of our guys is working on a barge at the moment. You know, just a random smattering of stuff. So, you know, it's really good for us and our team to keep our brains ticking over, and everything's a real challenge. In terms of the materiality and the trades, we have a rule in our office, which is no more than three new things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, when you look at, when you work outside up here, it's very hot. It's very hot. It's very hard to hold a plan, concentrate. You know, I was digging the trenches for the power to be run into the office and I couldn't think, you know. So it's about taking that, you know, I guess that the way that someone normally constructs something, learning that intrinsically in and out, and then going, right, how can we make this better? How can we tweak this result to end up with a better outcome for the project, client, the users, without compromising the build quality or the contractor's ability to deliver the project?
Right, okay. So then with those, the three new things, what have you found are the go-to or the un-new things that you use consistently that are reliable for you? And then, you know, what have you started to try to experiment with to expand on what you're doing?
Yeah, I guess I know there's a very famous quote from an architect that says, if your roof isn't leaking, your architect hasn't tried hard enough.
Right.
Now,
I think that's a little bit like Frank Lloyd Wright's, you know, doctors get to bury their mistakes and architects have to plant vines.
Yeah. I think it was actually a Frank Lloyd Wright quote. But anyway, you know, we're bush architects, so no leaky roofs.
Okay.
No leaky roofs. Then, that's something we stick pretty vehemently to. We make sure that, you know, there's a pitch on a roof, and, you know, we spend a lot of time going around fixing up roofs that, you know, leak. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you get a, you know, half a meter of rain in 2 days, you can see why.
Yeah.
And lack of maintenance as well. I mean, you can build any kind of roof structure, but it always needs maintenance. So I guess that's something we start with whenever we're coming up with something, is, you know, trying to make sure that, you know, it's going to handle no maintenance, essentially. Zero to no maintenance over the building's life. And that filters its way right the way down to things like the walls and the floors and the skirting. And then the other challenge is working out what products we can actually get to site and the lead times. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're looking at speccing product in Sydney, for example, that has a 6 to 8 week lead time, you double those lead times easily up here.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just about finding Australian stocked products, you know. And then also, I guess, I know where I'm going with this. I'm going off a bit of a tangent there, Daniel.
That's all right.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Each project is so different. Each project we do is so different. So everything is a case-by-case basis. You know, to do remote community housing, we're going to have a very different approach to doing a clinic building, for example. We have worked in a lot of the cultural kinship relationship observations when we do design. So things like dual access, how we can facilitate avoidance, how we can just incorporate some more outdoor spaces. And there's a lot of lessons to be learned about, you know, going back over projects that both us and other architects have done up here.
Yeah.
And learning
I think those sorts of lessons and knowing how to work with Indigenous communities is is a vital one. And so I wondered if you do you want to expand a little bit more on what those dual access and avoidance design principles are, just for our audience, whether they're architects or not, so that they can know, you know, oh, yeah, you can't just design, you know, with business as usual in mind in Indigenous communities.
No, you can't. And it really depends on, it's like going to, I guess what a lot of people forget is, you know, we're a very big country, as I sort of explained before. You know, we're talking about countries within countries. So the way that one mob of people approach a building is going to be very different, right, to the way another mob. There is similarities. And, you know, I'll start over, but the, I guess if some of those cultural observations are still observed, things like, you know, not being able to speak or be in the same room as your mother-in-law, I mean, great in my opinion.
Right. But. And is this the avoidance, designing for avoidance? Is that that kind of
thing? Yes, designing for avoidance. So there's some areas that will have those avoidance relationships very strictly followed, and other areas where there's not. You know, somewhere like Balgo, there's a very strong observation of those avoidance relationships. You know, we had Christmas lunch with a lady by the name of Tossie Badjo, and she was born in the desert before white man even came out there. You know,
wow.
So when she came and had dinner, or Christmas lunch with us, it was the first time she'd ever seen prawns or pavlova, something we sort of take for granted and identify as quintessentially Australian. So, you know, there's a breadth of cultural observations that people have, and it depends on where you're located that we acknowledge that. And a lot of it is community-led. So the community will say to us, oh, no, we definitely want some outside sitting areas. We definitely want, you know, to avoid this person, or we definitely want to sort of ignore all of that and just build a traditional building you'd find in the city.
Yeah, interesting. Okay.
So it's there's no right answer, and there never will be. And to put a blanket statement across it that you need to always do avoidance relationships is not the case. You know, yes, things like public buildings should have more of that to facilitate a wider breadth of people. But when you're designing buildings to specific clients in specific areas, you definitely need to be considerate of how they will use the building, you know, and putting a blanket statement of, you know, all Indigenous people must have avoidance relationships is, you know, is not the case.
Yeah. And so what was that other principle that you were talking about with dual access? When does that, what's the story behind dual access, and when is that required?
So that pertains more to the avoidance relationship. So if someone walks into a room and the other person is not supposed to be there because of the avoidance relationships, it means that I can exit quickly and not have to go past them.
Yeah, right. That's fascinating.
You create separate rooms, and some areas also prefer things like separate men's and women's waiting areas. You know, separation of genders, separation of kinship relationships. It can get quite complex. And that's why I say it's very project dependent.
Yeah, I've heard of a hospital, and I think it was in South Australia, where there was a men's entrance and a women's entrance, specifically because it was designed for, or they knew that there were quite a lot of Indigenous communities nearby who would want to make sure that there were those different you know, people could come in for different reasons, especially for giving birth and things like that. So, it must be a fascinating community to be working with. And you also mentioned that you work with ALOs, or Aboriginal Liaison Officers, on some of your projects. Do you want to talk a little bit about how you've factored that into your practice?
Yeah, so for each of the projects, it's always good to have someone on the ground who knows the background and can help us, you know, navigate all of these complexities, because we're Switzerland. We don't take sides. We don't come with our own preconceived ideas. We have two ears for listening and one mouth, so we should listen twice as much. You know, we try our very best to employ as many local people as possible, and that helps us, you know, go through the process of including language and also speaking to the right people. So the Aboriginal layers and officers, who to actually speak to on that, and they'll all be employed on a project-by-project basis. In addition to our sort of roles that we've got dedicated in terms of office assistants and, you know, trainee drafts people and that sort of thing. Because our main objective is to, you know, in 10, 15 years' time, I think the community should be running an architectural practice. You know, there's such a need for it that I think we should be doing everything we possibly can to let people see that there is an opportunity to become a professional up here and then take that on themselves.
Yeah, and it must be interesting when you are looking for new people, asking people, you know, putting the call out there to say, you know, hey, you know, this is a great lifestyle, come and work up here. How do you go with the responses when you put that that call out there?
To be honest with you, Mr. Moore, it's hard work. It's hard work. It's you know, it's so challenging because I mean, a lot of architects would never ever associate what we do and how we operate, you know, how relaxed our practice is with our khaki shirts and Crocs with architecture. It's, you know, and it takes a special kind of person to sort of come up here and embrace the lifestyle. We're a very open practice. We have everyone from, you know, grandparents to fathers to, you know, to mothers to, you know, single people. We have people from all walks of life within our practice. And it's not about what their ability is. It's about who they are as people. And that's very important for us. You know, you can teach Revit. You know, you can teach some design aspects, but you can't teach people to be a good human and to fit in with the community and be community-centric. So that's very important to us. Whenever we bring someone up here into a remote location, you know, we don't want to, I don't really care about that portfolio, but you know, it's not about that for us. It's about, you know, finding people who will join the local footy club and who have interests outside of architecture.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is challenging in architecture, believe it or not, because, you know, we're on a podcast about architecture.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just talking about architecture, whereas, you know, that's the last thing we want to speak about in our practice.
Yeah, it definitely helps, you know, like having a well-rounded person who can also think about all sorts of things that are happening in the whole community when, you know, when you're designing, must factor in so much more than just the practicalities of, you know, how doors swing and how, you know, how a roof drains. And there's
all that stuff to be taught.
Yeah.
You know, that's why we go and study in architecture school.
Yeah. And I like when you were saying, you know, if you can teach someone Revit, but there are, you know, other nuances and intricacies that are much, much harder to teach. You mentioned that, you know, sometimes you even have to design a little bit differently or document a little bit differently. And I can understand that working with people on country, sometimes you might have to, I guess, show your projects in, you can show them on drawings, but they might, you know, still be other ways that you can show that. How have you actually documented or approached your documentation slightly differently in the past on your projects out there?
Yeah, look, yeah, and I'll keep saying this throughout this interview, Daniel, it depends on the client. Look, we have found that, you know, the renders and 3D visuals have come a long way in the last 10, 15 years, and they are very good at helping people understand what things, you know, look like and feel like. But it is always good to sort of sit down with people and make sure their eyes aren't glazing over and they're paying attention to, you know, how this floor plan works, and, you know, the amount of space that they've got there and how that sits. You know, I always carry a tape measure with me, you know, always use items as a reference. You know, oh, you can fit five chairs in this room. You know, just bringing it down to the level that, you know, people are familiar with. I think that's really key. And really good architecture is to, you know, if you say 10, you know, your bedroom's 10 square meters, you and I would both know what that is. But if you break it down to, oh, it feels comfortable doing this, then people can really visualize it quite well.
Yeah, that's a good call.
Yeah, it's never really an issue with remote communities and that sort of thing. To be brutally honest with you, it's always an issue with the government. They're the ones who... who we struggle with in terms of conveying those messages. No, you'll be fine in this room. Oh, but these numbers say we can't, you know.
Yeah.
And in saying that, you know, moving on to sort of some of our other clients is government. We tread this weird line between we do a lot of government work to pay for our more sort of socialist work, I guess, you know, pro bono work. So we do all the government jobs to pay for those jobs that we like to do as freebies or heavily discounted, et cetera, et cetera. So that gives us not only the breadth of work, but also, you know, allows us to sort of help give some local influence to some of the government projects. You know, there's one thing that, you know, I'm a big fan of, but, you know, is very difficult to navigate, particularly in terms of the cultural element, is, you know, the advent of the all-gender toilet. You know, there's plenty of people from the city that are pushing that up here, whereas staff on the ground are like, this is really going to cause conflict and really not going to work in this environment. So it's about us taking the lead on that and saying, well, you know, let's do this to make both solutions work.
Mm. Now, I think that's great, you know, it's sort of like the community consultation approach, which is, you know, so important for communities that have been asking for infrastructure for a very long time. And in terms of the pro bono work that you do off the back of the government work that you do, what are some of the projects that that you've taken on board to deliver via pro bono?
We start with a lot of funding applications. Mm-hmm. So things like Lotteries West grants, NIDA grants, any sort of government grants, because, you know, there's a massive need for a lot of these facilities, and we'll help the projects get off, get the funding. And then that's when we can actually start charging feeable work for us. So it's about helping the client through that process. And then once they have the money, then we can actually run it like a traditional project.
Right. So these are sort of like the pro bono work portion of it, the bit at the beginning to help make sure that they've got the funding to get it built. And then, yeah.
So we have about, I'd say about 12 different projects which have applications in for funding. You know, of those 12, 4 may get funding. So, you know, we're only really going to get paid for 4 of those 12 projects.
Mm, okay.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. In saying that, yeah, it is a challenge to run a regional practice because, you know, the cost of living is higher up here. Mm. You know, transport, you know, wages, fuel, you name it. It's all a lot more expensive. And, you know, part of the advocacy work, some of the advocacy work we're trying to push as well is regional loading on architectural fees. So I think that's something that's sort of, you know, been lost a little bit with professional services. We haven't really picked our path. We consider ourselves very much part of the construction industry and therefore should be treated as such, whereas some practices more align themselves with consultants and that sort of field of things. So that as well as pushing for more digital online services, things like getting, being harassing Cameron on a weekly basis to try and get ABIC digitized. Sorry, Cameron. But I do have a reminder in my email that reminds me every week to send you an email.
No, I think all of that is absolutely necessary. I mean, the idea of getting, like, and even when you mentioned fuel, like just getting from your office to a site that must be, you know, if it might be 10 hours drive away, all of that time spent where you can't necessarily also be following up with emails or being on CAD when you're just doing all of that commuting. I mean, all
it's
of that has to come
it's
from
great.
Somewhere.
It's great. You can have time to think.
So you're just sort of doing it all in your head as you drive.
I have no reception between my house and my office. Mm. And it's fantastic because it gives me 5 minutes to just take a walk and just take a breath.
Yeah, nice. Cool. Yeah.
But, you know, it's, yeah, you need that sometimes. Yeah, I think looking after yourself is important.
Yeah, nice.
And, you know, our projects, we'd love to be, you know, on that fuel sort of, don't let me take over the interview, Daniel, sorry.
No, that's okay.
on that fuel side of things, you know, we'd love nothing more than to be carbon neutral, you know, passive house, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Hmm.
But, you know, until we sort of start to get parity with housing and health outcomes, you know, we'd love to be carbon neutral and have carbon neutral projects, but it's just not feasible at the moment. We can't deliver projects for a cost-effective basis without doing having some sort of impact. I'd love to run a fleet of EVs rather than Hiluxes, but we go to places where there are no charging stations, and they do require a four-wheel drive, which you need to put into low range to go through water crossings and things like that. So it's very hard for us as a practice to also try and push some of these new agendas. We feel like we're 20 years behind in some regards.
But, I think you're still rolling with the practicalities of the isolation and the conditions out there. So, when people are talking about sustainability and weighing up, say a steel frame versus a timber frame, I'm not sure if, out in remote WA, steel frames might just stand the test of time better and be able to handle extreme heat better than timber can or something, or maybe just timber's prohibitively expensive. Is there a call like that between the sort of building systems that you use where some people would say, oh, no, when you have access to all of these materials, this one, because it's got higher sustainability credentials, we'd go with that. But then when you look at it in terms of the length of a project, so let's say we're talking about a house, you might think, well, a steel frame might be able to stand up for a longer period of time. I'm not sure. Is there something like that that is very particular to regional work, like those with those materials, like, there's a different factor in that sustainability consideration?
Yeah, 100%. It's timber frames get chewed out by termites tomorrow. You can build with timber, but again, like, we come back to no more than three new things on a site. And steel frame is the status quo. It works. It's cheap. It's lightweight. The cost of transport is less. It's less wear and tear on vehicles and machinery and that sort of stuff. So, for those sort of things, we do try and push the limits where we can, try and add some more sustainability elements where we can. But then there also becomes down to, like I said before, the practicalities of maintenance, and how the client will look after the building. If the building is neglected for its entire life, we will do things like lime walls with fiber cement cladding, because it's more resilient than plasterboard, and double skin, that sort of thing that just lasts a bit longer. And then also looking at building in flood resilience, flood and heat resilience is very important. I think, we also need to consider the environmental impact of, what happens if this building does get destroyed in a natural disaster and then we have to rebuild it again. We're doubling our carbon footprint. So, being responsible in that regard as well.
Yeah, and how do you manage having so many projects? I know you mentioned that you've got 12 just in funding at the moment that you're trying to get funding for. I'm not sure how many you have in practice at any one time, but you've already mentioned that you've got three offices technically. How do you manage having so much ground to cover between, across such a massive state? I mean, I think if Europeans knew how much land you had to cover, they'd probably just be flabbergasted.
Look, just good people, Dan.
Yeah.
Honestly, good people who love it, I think you really have to love a place to be able to do the work that we do. It's not about, it's not just about architecture. It's about, waking up in the morning and being happy where you are. We're busy. We're very busy. But, at the end of the day, our working, whilst I might spend, say, a solid 2 days in the car over the period of a month, my commute time is, I think the longest commute time we have in our office is 10 minutes. It's about looking at things from a different perspective.
Yeah, nice.
Which means you have more productive time.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a really good thing to remember. And when it comes to, designing for people who are that isolated if you're working on do you work on many residential homes as well as sort of more community projects?
Not really, Daniel. We're pretty particular at the clients we choose. And the residential market up here is very, very interesting and nuanced market because, as soon as you start to look at things like mortgages and funding, I above the 26 parallel, the banks are very reluctant to lend to certain areas that we work in. So it's also about acknowledging that and what can be done in that regard. You know, we do have the occasional residential project that pop up, but most of the time they're just projects we do for clients who we're doing other projects for anyway. Mm. Most of our core work is, you know, for Indigenous corporations. So, you know, things like, you know, offices, public buildings, right the way through to toilet blocks, and then the government work side of things. So, you know, fit outs of police stations, you know, main roads, department of communities, all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's funny because a lot of people in architecture are like, I want to design houses, which is great. And it's fundamentally how a lot of people get into architecture. Mm. But there's, you know, in, you can really, really do some cool stuff and really push the boundaries with different types of buildings. And they always keep you on your toes because, you know, you're always thinking, oh, you know, it's not just this person, this particular person who's going to use this building. You need to design for everyone.
Mm.
It's a very inclusive way to think about things as well.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. And, I mean, those are the buildings that so many more people will use, you know, rather than just a single family potentially when you're talking about designing for houses. So it must also have, you know, a great feedback loop for yourself, you know, saying that a whole community can use this you know, wonderful thing that you've designed for all kinds of uses. And when it comes to, you know, some of these items that you've talked about or the issues that you talked about in terms of flood resilience and also just, you know, heat tolerance and termite resistance. And I guess the idea of the isolation, and especially when it comes to the wet season and dry season, and you mentioned, you know, you're being isolated for 3 days. When it comes to the design of these community buildings, do you have to factor in the idea of any of these buildings being like a refuge so that if people do, you know, if there's some sort of weather event, people have to or people can be able to use these buildings as a refuge for some time?
It's also, I guess, leading on to that, it's also, you know, about how the building can be used as an alternate purpose.
Okay.
You know, so if we design something that's an office block, you know, if this, you know, agency or organization loses funding tomorrow and they need to completely adapt their business model, how can this building facilitate that? So it's about creating spaces that can be used in more than one manner. You know, yeah, I bring it back to the residential sort of project mindset. You know, it's you're not only designing for not just like one particular person or not just one particular organization, but you're designing for anyone and everyone, and also all the implications that come with things like building codes and how that building can be adapted in the future to meet a new standard or a new building typology. You know, it's not just a monotonal, you know, idea.
Yeah. And do you factor that in when you're doing sort of community consultation, I guess? Does
100%. 100%. Yeah. And it's, you know, I think it's very easy to become an architect who's like, yes, 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 I will do that. Yes, sir, 10 bags full. I'll design XYZ for you. People have a lot more respect for people when they turn around and say, I don't think that's a good idea.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's, I think there is a level of responsibility for us and for the community as a whole to turn around to clients and say, look, I don't think this is a very good idea. How about we do this instead? Yeah. Because there are so many buildings up here that, you know, incredible buildings won amazing architectural awards but never get used for, you know, the subsequent purposes that are needed down the line because nobody ever thought to stand up and say, is this actually able to be run as this and do they actually need it, you know? And it's not being paternalistic by any stretch of the imagination. It's just sort of, you know, confirming or reaffirming to the people that that's exactly what they want, not just being, you know, a yes man that says, yes, 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 we can do this. And that's a very challenging thing as an architect because you need the work. And sometimes people come to you with some incredible projects that you just sort of have to go, you know, it's a great idea, but I don't think it's going to work. In saying that, we've come up with some absolutely nuts ideas that have got off the ground. Yeah, you know, and from the outsider's perspective, they may seem like just a crazy idea and a folly. But again, it's about understanding how the community uses the buildings, and myself as a local, how I've seen patterns of the past operate. There's a lot to be said from learning lessons from the past.
I think it's interesting you brought up a few times, maintenance, ongoing maintenance is a big issue and needs to be considered really early on. I've had a design for low maintenance, and the idea of designing something, I guess, as well, that's isolated and might not be, and I'm not sure if I'm picking up on exactly what you're talking about, but there might be some community buildings that don't get used for quite some time. So factoring in how they're going to be programmed so that then, if someone does turn up, on a day when there might be someone not there, do you have a system in place to make sure that the building can be activated, or, how does the management of those buildings work during those times when you don't have someone programmed in there to actually facilitate the building? How do you run through that with people who might not have thought about, how buildings can be used more often than not? Because I think, maybe it's more of a Western idea that, someone has to be there to be almost like a caretaker for some community buildings, and then there might be other designs for buildings that can be left more open.
Yeah, I guess it's also about sitting down and understanding where people are, because there's a lot of communities that are seasonal. So they'll go to one spot for part of the year, another spot part of the year. This idea of, this Western idea of, this is your town you live in is very new in some instances. So there will be buildings that are left, vacant over the wet season or vacant over the dry season for periods of time. So it's about acknowledging that and designing, factoring that in. There's obviously been a lot of public attention on crime in the Kimberley as well. So designing so a building doesn't look like a prison, but, secure for its occupants and the organisations, but also is able to be prepared and fixed promptly as well for a low cost. Things like, can we get that glazing? Can we get that window? Can we get that panel? Can that be procured within a reasonable time frame to make the building good or secure? So there's a lot of consideration for that element as well.
Yeah, awesome. And I guess, are there some projects that you're really excited about that are coming down the pipe for EKD Architects that you can talk about that you'd really like to, that you can't wait to have either started or finished?
Yeah, look, we're doing some, interesting jobs. We're looking at doing some equestrian learning facilities in Broome. We're looking at doing some women's refuges down in Balgo and Halls Creek, looking at some more sporting facilities for the small community of Warman, as well as some teachers' housing in Pumalu. It's a lot of really exciting projects we're coming up. Barge that we're going to do in Kangara. On top of, projects that we venture out on our own. So we just finished building our own office. So
very nice.
Really trying to push the adaptive reuse sustainability aspect of things. So I went on a trip to Darwin and saw some houses in a paddock. It turned out they were the former RAAF officer housing.
Wow.
And there were two, when that area got developed, there were two new to sort of throw out. And, we saw a couple of them go, this could be an interesting idea. Anyway, 12 months down the track, we threw them on the back of a truck and took them across here and jacked them up nice and high. And I was sitting down at a function with Adrian from Troppo. And I said, you didn't design this building, did you? I have a sneaking suspicion this is a Troppo design. And he's like, yep, this is one of my buildings. And proceeded to tell us a story about how we designed all these military houses.
That's incredible. I'm surprised that the RAAF were happy to let them go.
So they gave them to a demolition contractor who we purchased them off. And it seems to be the most sustainable approach is to reuse what you can actually find around the place. You know, we're still working on our life cycle assessment for the project.
Right.
But as you said, I'm a very busy person and
we will eventually. Yeah. I'm sure that's going to have one of the lowest LFAs of all time. So it's going to be really exciting to see see the outcome from that. Yeah.
Yeah, and we sort of use it as a bit of a test case to, you know, the advantage of what you call in the tropics as a high-rise buildings. It seems to be a lot, you know, due to access constraints. It's been a very challenging thing to do nowadays, particularly in terms of universal accessibility for buildings and public buildings and whatnot. So we're sort of working through a process of how we can design more high-rises which let that tropical breeze flow under elevated array from any elements, even at a sacrificial level, you know, and working out how we can kind of research in a design solution to some of these, you know, previously utilized buildings that history has shown has worked quite well.
Yeah, that's fabulous. So I guess I'd love to finish this up, like thinking about or asking you about, in terms of being the most isolated architect in the country, would you be happy to have more architects come out to remote or very remote WA and do more work out there? Or have you got any advice for anyone who'd might have listened to this podcast and then be thinking, you know, oh, maybe it'd be nice to go and move our practice up there? What do you think they should consider before they make the move?
Look, you know, I didn't just fly up here and start my practice immediately. You know, I was a community member well before I started this practice. You know, we need architects where there are none. You know, it's a harsh condition. You know, you picture these places, the sun is unbearably hot. You can't go out in the middle of the day. There's no, the water that may not be potable that comes out the tap. You know, the idea of, you know, a sewage solution is a hole in the ground. You know, these are the places we need more architects and professionals, not the cities where, you know, there's leafy suburbs, neighbours that don't blare music 24/7 and dogs that aren't going to attack you in the street. It's these areas that we need more good design. In saying that, you know, I don't think there should be a push towards the FIFO architecture mentality that we've seen in the past. You know, and the outcomes can be pretty poor and the community doesn't respond very well to that sort of attitude. My advice to anyone who wants to move bush and to start their own firm bush is to really think about why. Why do you want to move bush? You know, is it just because you're fed up with the city, or is it because, you know, you have a socialist agenda where you want to help people? And then live in a place. Live in a place and be part of the community. You know, remote and regional Australia is very community centric. You know, CWAs and neighborhood houses and that sort of thing. That's how we operate up here. And in most of remote Australia. So don't go in with guns blazing. Yeah, we've got, like I said before, we've got two ears for listening, one mouth for speaking. Yeah, even though I spoke a lot on this, Dan.
That'd be hard if you could just
like that podcast.
So I was trying to use my two ears for you, and that was fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah. We do need more professionals, where there are none. It's, the community outcomes need to improve, and there's only one. There's many ways that we're going to achieve it, and one of those is putting professionals in those areas. And we as an architect can be leaders in that. We can say, you know, we understand your conditions you live in because we live in it ourselves. You know, there's a lot of design sympathy when you experience what someone else is experiencing.
Yeah.
And people have more respect for that as well.
Yeah, totally hear that. I think, people who just come in and straight off the plane and think they can solve a problem, it's, you know, they're not going to probably get to the deep depths of everything that's happened in the community over a long period of time. So I think that's very, very sage advice.
It takes 2 years before someone will even listen to you or even give you a platform to listen to your voice. You know, everyone just sees a revolving door of CEOs, architects, you name it. They come through, and then 2 years later, there's someone else new. So I think it's always good to be mindful of that as well.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
And to be a good human Okay.
Yeah, it's right. It's good. We do actually have to remind people of that, I think, a lot more these days. So, yeah, just be good humans and, yeah, take care of everyone else. So I think you're doing a great job in that arena. So thank you so much, Mike Sneed from EKD Architects up in what, beyond the 26th parallel. Is that right? Or around the 26th parallel? What would you say?
Well beyond.
Well beyond the 26th parallel.
So I think we're closer to the equator.
Right. Okay. Gosh. Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast and sharing what it's like working as a very remote architect in Australia, if not the most remote architect in Australia. We can't wait to see what EKD Architects produces in the future. So thank you so much, and we hope to have you on the podcast again.
Thank you, Daniel. Appreciate it.
This has been Hearing Architecture, proudly sponsored by Brickworks. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you so much to our guest, registered architect and director of EKD Architects in WA, Mike Sneed. Thank you again for talking about your unique work and the realities of working in regional Western Australia. We can't wait to see what EKD does next. Our sponsor Brickworks also produce architecture podcasts hosted by Tim Ross. You can find The Art of Living, Architects Abroad and The Power of Two at brickworks.com.au or your favourite podcast platform. If you'd like to show your support, please rate, review and subscribe to Hearing Architecture in your favourite podcast app. If you want to know more about what the Australian Institute of Architects is doing to support architects and the community, please visit architecture.com.au. This is a production by the Australian Institute of Architects, Emerging Architects and Graduates Network, in collaboration with Open Creative Studio. The Institute production team was Madeline Jenkins and Claudia McCarthy, and the Imagine production team was Daniel Moore. This content is brought to you by the Australian Institute of Architects, Emerging Architects and Graduates Network, in collaboration with Open Creative Studio. This content does not take into account specific circumstances and should not be relied on in that way. This content does not constitute legal, financial, insurance, or other types of advice. You should seek independent verification or advice before relying on this content in circumstances where loss or damage may result. The Institute endeavours to publish content that is accurate at the time it is published, but does not accept responsibility for content that may or will become inaccurate over time.